May 30th, 2009, Miami, Florida. While spending the night partying at a nightclub, 21-year-old Omar LaPara becomes very intoxicated and never returns home. 3 days later, Omar's dismembered remains are found in multiple garbage bags on the shores of Biscayne Bay. Investigators look into a number of different leads, including an individual who used Omar's cell phone following his disappearance and an eyewitness sighting of Omar's unconscious body being placed into a vehicle by two unidentified men. But his murder is never solved. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be exploring a very brutal and disturbing crime, the 2009 murder of Omar LaPara. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Maria Sachery, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Maria. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been carrying on for nearly 6 years now, so if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, the murder of Omar LaPara was the case that Maria suggested I cover when she originally entered this contest, and it is definitely one of the more violent and senseless murders we've ever covered on this podcast. Omar LaPara was a Guatemalan national living in Miami who went missing after partying at a nightclub, and a few days later, plastic bags containing Omar's dismembered remains would be discovered on the shores of Biscayne Bay. The case wound up receiving national coverage when it was featured on an episode of the true crime TV series, The First 48, and it showed detectives turning up a very promising lead when a potential suspect was caught using Omar's cell phone after he went missing. However, it turns out this person may not have actually been responsible for Omar's murder, and while there have been a couple of interesting developments over the years, including a potential link to notorious Canadian killer Luca Magnotta, this crime has never been solved. Since there isn't a ton of information available about this case, I'm also going to be spending this episode discussing another crime in which the dismembered remains of a murder victim were found in Miami's Biscayne Bay, and that's the 1985 murder of Nilsa Padilla. It would be nearly 27 years before Nilsa was identified, and while it seems pretty clear-cut that she was murdered by her abusive spouse, he is currently a wanted fugitive and has never been arrested for this crime. This is a very sad and complicated case, because Nilsa had a 2.5-year-old daughter named Alicia Padilla who went missing a few months after Nilsa was killed and has not been found to this day. In addition, the dismembered remains of a male victim were found in Biscayne Bay around the same time that Nilsa was, but he has never been identified, and it's unclear if his death has any connection to this case. So I'm going to start off this episode by discussing Omar LaPara's murder, and then I'll move on to sharing Nilsa and Alicia's story. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the murder of Omar LaPara. All Our story begins in Miami, Florida in 2009, and our central figure is 21-year-old Osben Lapara, who goes by the name Omar. Omar is a Guatemalan national who has been in the United States for the past 7 years and makes his living working in construction as a day laborer, and he's also the goalie on a local soccer team. Omar shares an apartment with his two brothers, Elvio and Henry, and along with their sister, they often send some of the money they make back home to their parents in Guatemala. On the evening of Saturday, May the 30th, Omar and Elvio decided to go to El Mexicano, a restaurant located in the Little Havana neighborhood, which has an upstairs nightclub. The brothers were accompanied by two friends of theirs and would spend the night drinking and dancing, but at around 12:30 a.m. on May the 31st, Elvio and one of the friends decided to head home. After they left, Omar gradually became more intoxicated, and while his remaining friend called for a taxi and tried to convince Omar to leave as well, he insisted on staying. The friend left the club at 2 a.m. and would later say that he last saw Omar sitting alone at one of the tables in the corner. El Mexicano closed at 3 a.m., and while the other patrons were leaving, an off-duty police officer working security at the club came across Omar passed out at the table. He was able to wake Omar up, and even though he managed to drunkenly stumble out of the club, Omar never returned home. Over the course of the next 3 days, Omar's brothers were unable to get a hold of him on his cell phone, and none of his friends knew where he was. Even though they checked some of the local hospitals for Omar, there was no record of anyone matching his description having gone there for treatment. Well, at around 8:45 a.m. on the morning of June the 3rd, a man was cycling down the 79th Street Causeway near the Pelican Harbor Marina when he noticed what he described as a suspicious-looking black garbage bag lying along the shore of Biscayne Bay. He decided to call the Miami Police Department, and when detectives arrived at the scene, they discovered that the bag contained a dismembered left leg. Over the next few hours, police performed a search of Biscayne Bay and eventually came across an additional garbage bag floating about a quarter mile away from where the first bag had been found, and it contained a dismembered head and torso belonging to a male victim. The Miami PD had trouble identifying him at first, but when they asked the public for assistance, it wasn't long before they were contacted by one of Omar's friends, who informed them that he had been missing for 3 days. When detectives got in touch with Omar's brothers, they were able to positively identify the victim as him. The following day, a garbage bag containing Omar's dismembered right leg and his right arm was found floating in Biscayne Bay, and a second bag containing his left arm was soon found about a mile away. A cleaning crew would also find a bag of bloody clothing on Pompano Beach, which were believed to belong to Omar. Even after an autopsy was performed on the remains, the medical examiner was unable to determine Omar's exact cause of death, and no fingerprints could be found on the garbage bags. While Omar had one previous arrest for disorderly intoxication, his family insisted that he did not use drugs and he had no known enemies. None of Omar's personal items, including a cell phone, wallet, and wristwatch, were found with his remains, but investigators received a big break when they discovered that a number of calls had been made from Omar's cell phone after he originally went missing. Phone records showed that the calls were received by a brother and sister living in Hollywood, Florida, and after detectives got in touch with them, they learned that the caller had been their sibling, whose name was Omar Bravo. When Bravo was brought in for questioning, he denied having any involvement in Omar Lapara's murder, and initially claimed to have no idea who he was. According to Bravo, he had been hanging around outside El Mexicano sometime after 3 a.m. on May the 31st, when he was suddenly approached by a man who offered to sell him a cell phone because he needed the money for crack. Bravo decided to buy the phone and used it to make a few calls to his brother and sister before he subsequently sold it at a pawn shop. Well, detectives took Bravo to Little Havana in hopes of finding this so-called crackhead who had supposedly sold him the cell phone. They had no success, so Bravo was given a voice stress analysis test, and after being told that he failed it, Bravo changed his story. He now claimed that during the early morning hours of May the 31st, he had come across Omar Lapara lying on the street about a block away from El Mexicano. Since Lapara appeared to be intoxicated and had passed out, Bravo decided to take advantage of the situation by stealing his wallet, watch, and cell phone. Bravo said that he initially lied about this because he was worried he would be charged with robbery, but he insisted that LaPara was alive when he last saw him and continued to deny any involvement in his murder. Well, as unbelievable as Bravo's story might have sounded, an eyewitness would soon come forward who appeared to corroborate his version of events. This witness worked at a store located across the street from El Mexicano and confirmed that she had seen Omar LaPara lying passed out on the ground about a half hour after Bravo claimed to have robbed him. In fact, according to the witness, sometime between 4:15 and 4:30 a.m., she saw two men help Omar up and place him inside a car. She described the two men as being Latino and in their 30s, and the vehicle may have been a tan or beige-colored older model Honda Accord. After Omar was placed in the car, the witness said that one of the men climbed inside and drove away, but the second man took off in the opposite direction on a bicycle. This led to speculation that the two men did not actually know each other, as the bicyclist may have been a bystander who was just passing through the area until the driver asked him for assistance helping Omar into his car. When investigators checked footage from the security cameras in the area, they were able to find footage of a vehicle matching the witness's description driving through Little Havana at around 4:15 a.m. that morning. However, since the camera was located a great distance away, the footage was not clear enough to make out the car's license plate number or the driver. Even after this footage was released to the media, the vehicle could not be identified, and while police also asked the bicyclist to come forward, he never did. Based on this eyewitness's information, detectives seemed satisfied that Omar Bravo was not involved in the murder and released him from custody without any robbery charges. The case would be featured on an episode of The First 48 titled Body of Evidence, which aired in January of 2010, but it failed to bring about any new leads. However, the case would briefly return to the spotlight 2 years later when investigators looked into a possible connection with one of the most notorious criminals in the history of Canada, Luca Rocco Magnotta. I'm not going to go into too many details about Magnotta's background because his story has already been extensively covered on podcasts and true crime media in general, but if you want to learn more information, there is a 3-part docuseries about his story on Netflix titled Don't Fuck with Cats, Hunting an Internet Killer. Long story short, when he was 29 years old, Magnotta murdered a 33-year-old Chinese-born computer engineering student named Jun Lin, who was attending Concordia University in Montreal, Quebec. On May the 24th, 2012, after the two men met on Craigslist, Magnotta lured Lin to his apartment and brutally murdered and dismembered him before mailing some of his remains to various locations throughout Canada. The case would attain worldwide notoriety when a video that Magnotta had shot of the crime was shared over the internet, so he became the subject of an international manhunt before he was apprehended in Berlin on June the 4th. When Magnotta went on trial in December of 2014, he was found guilty of first-degree murder and many other charges, and received a sentence of life imprisonment plus 19 additional years, which would be served concurrently. While following Magnotta's arrest, law enforcement did explore his potential involvement in other unsolved murders involving dismemberment, including that of Omar LaPara. It turned out that in August of 2010, Magnotta had posted photographs of himself sitting inside a Lotus sports car on various message boards, claiming that he had just received the vehicle as a graduation gift after moving to Miami. Naturally, this made investigators curious about whether Magnotta could be placed in Miami in May of 2009 at the time of Omar's murder, but it wasn't long before this possibility was dismissed. According to the moderator of one of these message boards, IP address records show that Magnotta was actually in Toronto when he made these posts, and the photos of him inside the Lotus did not appear to have been taken at any recognizable location in Miami. In the end, the Miami PD released a statement in which they confirmed that Magnotta was not in Miami at the time Omar was killed and ruled him out as a suspect in the crime. But unfortunately, there have not been any further developments in the investigation during the past decade, so Omar LaPara's murder continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. As you can imagine, it's always incredibly disturbing whenever a victim is dismembered after they've been murdered, as most of us cannot even fathom having the willpower to do something like that to another human being. So whenever a crime like this takes place, you often get the impression that whoever the perpetrator was, it was not their first or only murder. Of course, I'm sure that once you heard the details of what happened to Omar LaPara, many of you probably had flashbacks to the hit fictional TV show Dexter, which takes place in Miami. As you probably know, it's based around a character named Dexter Morgan, a vigilante serial killer who murders other serial killers, and he would often dismember his victims and place the remains inside trash bags before traveling through Biscayne Bay and dumping the bags into what was described as an underwater graveyard. And well, given that Omar was murdered only a few years after Dexter first became a hit, you have to wonder if his killer may have been inspired by the show when they disposed of Omar's remains. Anyway, as a male Guatemalan national, Omar LaPara would ordinarily not fit the profile of a murder victim who got a lot of coverage from the media, but since his death just happened to take place in Miami, where a good chunk of the episodes for the first 48 were filmed, I'm sure the show was not going to turn down the opportunity to feature a crime in which the victim was dismembered and his remains were disposed of in various trash bags. Unfortunately, the exposure on the show did not lead to a resolution, and other than its brief mention in relation to Luca Magnotta in 2012, it sounds like the case has since completely faded from the spotlight. It seems like the Miami PD have a fairly good idea of how Omar became the victim of foul play, as it sounds like someone took advantage of him while he was in a highly inebriated state. But what we don't know is the identity of the perpetrator, as well as their motive for murdering Omar in such a brutal fashion. I can understand why investigators explored the possibility that Luca Magnotta might be the perpetrator, as the murder of June Lin was so brutal and senseless that you can understand why attempts would be made to link him to other unsolved homicides in North America involving dismemberment. In addition to Omar LaPara's case, the authorities looked at Magnotta as a potential suspect in the murder of Harvey Medellin, a 66-year-old man who was found decapitated and dismembered under the Hollywood sign in Los Angeles in January of 2012. However, another suspect named Gabriel Campos Martinez was eventually charged with that crime, and officially, June Lin remains Magnotta's only victim. The only piece of evidence which suggests that Magnotta could have been involved in Omar's murder were the message board posts he made featuring photos of him in a Lotus, which he claimed he was driving through Miami, but he apparently made these posts in Toronto, and there's nothing to indicate that Magnotta ever visited Miami, let alone was there in May of 2009. Given how there aren't all that many murder cases involving dismemberment, I can definitely understand why it would be tempting to link Magnotta to this case, but the MOs between the two crimes seem to be a lot different. The murder of June Lin was premeditated, as Magnotta met him over the internet and lured him to his apartment to be killed. However, the murder of Omar LaPara seemed to be completely random, as he supposedly passed out drunk on the street for an extended period of time until he was picked up by his killer, so it sounds like he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. I think it's safe to say that Luca Magnotta has pretty much been ruled out as a suspect here, and his whole connection was nothing but a red herring, but of course, you have to wonder who really was responsible for this crime. As far as I know, no other dismembered murder victims were found in the Miami area during this time period to indicate there was a serial killer on the loose, so could Omar have really been this person's only victim? Well, during the early stages of the investigation, it seemed like the most promising suspect was Omar Bravo, since he literally used Omar LaPara's cell phone after he was presumed to have been murdered. Bravo's original story was that he came across LaPara passed out on the street and decided to steal his phone, wristwatch, and wallet, and by pure chance, a completely different person just happened to come across LaPara a short time later and decided to abduct and murder him. When I first read about this part of the case, I immediately rolled my eyes at Bravo's story, but it turns out that truth may have actually been stranger than fiction here, and it sounds like the detectives working the case were inclined to believe him. If you watch the first 48 episode, they show some of Bravo's interrogation footage after he's brought in for questioning, and you get the sense that he seems genuinely shocked once he learns that he's been caught using a cell phone belonging to someone who was murdered and dismembered. Yes, Bravo didn't do himself any favors when he lied about the circumstances of how he stole the phone, but he does come across like someone who committed a petty crime and had no idea that it could potentially lead to him being implicated in a murder he had nothing to do with, so he was just making up any story he could in order to cover his tracks. However, I think Bravo just got incredibly lucky that an independent eyewitness came forward who could confirm having seen La Parra passed out on the sidewalk about a half hour or so after Bravo claimed to have robbed him and reported seeing him get placed inside a car by two other individuals. In the end, it really does not seem like Bravo played any role in this murder, and it's just a very odd coincidence that he wound up robbing someone who got killed a short time later. But while that makes Bravo seem like a very unlucky person, the same logic could also apply to one of the men who helped place La Parra inside the car, as he may have been a completely innocent bystander who had no idea he was assisting someone who was about to commit murder. So as you recall, the eyewitness who saw the two men place Omar in the vehicle said that only one of them climbed inside and drove away, while the other one took off in the opposite direction on a bicycle. Since the security camera got a shot of a car driving through the area at that time, which seemed to match the description of the vehicle that the witness provided, this definitely suggests that her story was true, but did the driver and the bicyclist actually know each other? Well, I personally believe that the bicyclist probably had no involvement in the murder and was just an innocent bystander passing through the area until the driver asked him for assistance, helping him get Omar inside his car. If the driver fed the bicyclist a story about how Omar was his friend and he'd gotten drunk and passed out, then the bicyclist probably had no reason to be suspicious at that time. Investigators were hoping that if the bicyclist was a bystander, he would come forward and provide additional information about the vehicle and the driver, but he never did. I mean, he could have been paranoid that he would be implicated in the murder, or perhaps he had his own personal reasons for not wanting to speak with law enforcement, such as immigration issues. But maybe he simply never even heard about Omar's death in the news and had no idea the police were looking for him. Whatever the case, it seems like without the assistance of this eyewitness, investigators just hit a dead end trying to figure out who was responsible for this crime. It's apparent that Omar got heavily intoxicated at El Mexicano and left when the club closed at 3 a.m., and while attempting to walk home, he fell over and passed out. I find it interesting that the witness reported seeing Omar being picked up and placed inside the car sometime between 4:15 and 4:30 a.m., meaning that he had been lying passed out on the street for over an hour. I was considering the possibility that Omar's killer had also gone to El Mexicano that night and set their eyes on him, or even drugged one of his drinks. However, if they followed him outside after closing time, I don't think they would have waited for nearly an hour and a half to pick Omar up. Omar did not appear to have any known enemies, and even if he did, I'm not sure how they would know to find him on that particular street at that particular time. So this seems to indicate that a random stranger may have been driving through Little Havana during the early morning hours, noticed Omar lying passed out on the street, and decided to pull over to take advantage of the situation. And if Omar Bravo was telling the truth, he already would have stolen Omar's valuables before the killer even stopped, so robbery did not appear to be the motive for this crime. Sexual assault definitely could have been a motive, but it's never been reported if there were any signs of assault on Omar's body. It sounds like investigators have still been unable to determine Omar's exact cause of death, but I get the impression that he was already dead before the dismemberment took place. However, since Omar's remains were not found for 3 days, it's also possible he could have still been alive and held in captivity for a period of time after he was picked up. But it's certainly terrifying to think that some random stranger could have seen Omar lying on the street and just felt a sudden compulsion to abduct, murder, and dismember him. Even though there have not been any other similar crimes like this in the Miami area, I'm still inclined to believe this is not this individual's only murder and that they may have harmed others. Unfortunately, they have given the authorities very little evidence to work with, and I'm not sure there's not much else they can do unless someone, such as the unidentified bicyclist, comes forward with important information. So if you happen to know anything about the unsolved murder of Omar LaPara, please contact the Miami-Dade and the Florida Keys Crime Stoppers tip line at 305-471-TIPS. That's 305-471-8477. So now let's move on to our next case, though be forewarned, this is a very disturbing story which involves child abuse. Our second story also takes place in Miami, Florida, and begins in 1985. On April the 4th of that year, a green garbage bag was discovered between two boulders on a beach on the shores of Biscayne Bay near the Rickenbacker Causeway. The bag contained the decomposed torso of an unidentified female which had been wrapped in a bedsheet. Over the course of the next 2 weeks, this victim's head, as well as one of her legs and thighs, would be recovered from Biscayne Bay, and it was apparent that a saw had been used to sever these extremities from her torso. The medical examiner was unable to determine an exact cause of death, but the victim did have a head injury to indicate that she had been struck with a blunt object. While the victim was estimated to be between 20 to 35 years old, all attempts to identify her went nowhere. Curiously, on April the 2nd, 2 days before the discovery of the Jane Doe, the partially dismembered and decomposing remains of a male victim had been found in the same area. He had washed up on another beach on the shores of Biscayne Bay near the Miami Seaquarium, about a third of a mile away from where the Jane Doe's torso was discovered. The man was believed to be white or Hispanic between the ages of 20 to 40 and had been killed with gunshot wounds to the chest and abdomen before he was dismembered. His most distinctive features included a hairy torso, an 11-inch diagonal scar on his back, a large gap between his front teeth, and the initials LR, which were tattooed on his upper right arm. But once again, the victim could not be identified, and while investigators could not be certain if the John and Jane Doe were connected to each other, they theorized that their murders might somehow be related to the drug trade. The victims wound up being given the nicknames Tommy and Teresa Torso, and that's how they would be known until a surprising development took place 25 years later. During the summer of 2010, Sergeant Charles McCulley, the head of the Miami-Dade Police Department's Cold Case Unit, was approached by a woman named Gloria Hampton, who marched into his office and stated, quote, "I just need somebody to listen to me. I saw my father kill my mother when I was 4 years old. He put her body into an army green bag," end quote. 2 decades earlier, Gloria and her older half-sister, Bernisa Davis, had been removed from the care of Gloria's abusive father, who had been living under the name Rafael Guzman at that time. According to Gloria, their mother, Nilsa Padilla, had been murdered sometime in 1985 when Gloria was 4 years old and Bernisa was 7. When Sergeant McCulley launched an investigation, he realized that this would have been the approximate time period when Teresa Torso's remains were found inside a green bag. DNA samples were eventually obtained from both Gloria and Bernisa for a comparison, and on March the 9th, 2012, it was announced that DNA testing had positively identified Teresa Torso as Nilsa Padilla. Nilsa originally hailed from the fishing town of Cataño, Puerto Rico, and had been 26 years old at the time of her death. Since both of her parents were alcoholics, Nilsa and her siblings often had to fend for themselves, and she was known for having a wild, rebellious side as she was growing up. By the summer of 1976, Nilsa had saved up enough money from housekeeping jobs that she was able to leave Puerto Rico and purchase a plane ticket to New York City. Sometime after she settled there, Nilsa became involved with a Puerto Rican man named Miguel Cruz and became pregnant with Bernisa. However, before the child could be born, Miguel and a friend of his were both arrested for their involvement in the rape of 2 women, and he wound up being sent to prison. Nilsa ended her relationship with Miguel and started raising Bernisa as a single mother, but she eventually started a relationship with another man named Rafael Guzman, who also claimed to be from Puerto Rico. Nilsa became pregnant and gave birth to her second daughter, Gloria, but while no one knew this at the time, it turned out that Rafael Guzman was actually an illegal immigrant from Peru named Jorge Walter Nunez, who had a history of arrests and prison stints under a number of different aliases for such crimes as grand larceny. According to Gloria and Bernisa, Jorge was a heavy drinker who physically and sexually abused them. The entire family resided in an old U-Haul truck, which Jorge had converted into a makeshift camper, and since both Jorge and Nielsa had issues with alcohol and drugs, neither of them held down jobs, and the family lived off of Nielsa's welfare checks. But the most surprising revelation provided by Gloria and Bernisa is that they had a younger sister named Alicia, who was born on July the 4th, 1982, and whose fate would become yet another unsolved mystery. By 1985, Nielsa, Jorge, and their three children were residing in their makeshift camper on the beaches of the island town of Key Biscayne, Florida. According to Bernisa and Gloria, they only attended school sporadically and would often pretty much have to feed themselves by fishing for shrimp and crabs. At one point, Nielsa's cousin, Maggie Soto, who resided in Connecticut, paid her a visit in Florida and learned that Nielsa had become an alcoholic in order to numb the depression of the constant violence and abuse at the hands of Jorge. Nielsa told Maggie that she was unable to leave Jorge because she had no money, and Maggie even witnessed Jorge threaten Nielsa and say, quote, "I'm fed up with her. One of these days, I'm going to kill her," end quote. According to Bernisa and Gloria, their mother was unaware of the sexual abuse that Jorge was inflicting on them, so one day, Bernisa decided to tell Nielsa about it while Jorge was out. Nielsa initially responded by calling Bernisa a liar and smacking her in the face, but when Jorge returned home, Nielsa did decide to confront him about it. This caused Jorge to go into a violent rage and strike Nielsa in the head with a bag containing a beer bottle, and when she tried to escape the camper, Jorge proceeded to beat her to death in front of the children. While Bernisa and Gloria both claimed to have no memory of witnessing Jorge dismember their mother, they did recall seeing him place Nielsa's body inside a green bag. He then presumably dumped her remains into Biscayne Bay, but while her torso washed up on shore a short time later, no one was able to figure out who Nielsa was, and she would be known as Teresa Torso for the next 27 years. The three girls would remain in Jorge's custody while he moved the camper to another section of Miami, but a few weeks later, another tragedy would occur with the youngest daughter, Alicia, who was only about 2.5 years old at that time. According to Bernisa, Jorge left the children some cereal to eat while he went out to grab a welfare check, but Bernisa was not hungry. She knew there would be repercussions from Jorge if she didn't finish her cereal, but since she didn't think he would go so far as to harm Alicia, Bernisa switched bowls with her before Jorge returned home. When Jorge arrived and noticed that Alicia had not finished her cereal, he struck her across the head and knocked her to the floor. Jorge then picked up Alicia's limp body and told the other two girls he was going to get some help before leaving the camper with Alicia. But this turned out to be the last time that Bernisa and Gloria ever saw their sister. For the next 4 years, the two girls remained in Jorge's custody as they traveled around Florida and he continued to abuse them. But in 1989, the police finally became involved when Jorge was arrested for attempting to sexually assault another girl who had been sleeping over with Bernisa and Gloria. When they were interviewed by police, the two girls finally worked up the courage to reveal what Jorge had done to them, and they were removed from his custody. Jorge was charged and convicted on 2 counts of lewd and lascivious acts on children and received a 3.5-year prison sentence, and by the time he was released, Bernisa and Gloria had changed their names and were now living in foster care. However, even though both girls made numerous attempts to tell the authorities that they had witnessed Jorge murder their mother and made their younger sister disappear, it seems like no one took them seriously and they were written off as suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and possibly having false memories. Gloria even arranged a meeting with some Miami homicide detectives in 2003 and once again tried to tell them that she had witnessed Jorge murder Nielsa, but they pretty much just blew her off and told her that they were too busy to provide any assistance. It was not until Gloria marched into Sergeant McCulley's office in 2010 when she finally found an investigator who was willing to look into her story, and McCulley became convinced that she was telling the truth, and this paved the way towards Nielsa being identified as Teresa Torso. On the basis of Gloria's story, an arrest warrant was issued, which charged Jorge with second-degree murder, but the problem was that he could not be located. Following his release from prison on the sexual abuse charges, Jorge pretty much spent the next decade living as a transient on the streets of Miami, and was rearrested on numerous occasions for other crimes before he was deported back to his native Peru in 2004. But while Peru does have an extradition treaty, which would allow Jorge to be brought back to the United States to face the murder charge, all attempts to locate him have been unsuccessful. Since Jorge's Peruvian identification number expired in 2010, investigators believe that he is either deceased or living entirely off the grid, or possibly living elsewhere under a false identity. As for Bernice and Gloria, even though they have both faced personal struggles over the trauma of their experiences, they have since started families of their own and agreed to be interviewed and share their story on a 2015 episode of the TV series True Crime with Aphrodite Jones, which was titled Memories of Murder. Jorge Walter Nunez continues to remain a wanted fugitive for Nielsen's murder, but there are two additional unresolved mysteries in this case. Alicia Padilla has not been seen since 1985, and while investigators are inclined to believe that she is dead, they cannot say so with 100% certainty until her remains are found. Another big unanswered question is the identity of the John Doe, known only as Tommy Torso, whose dismembered remains were discovered on the shores of Biscayne Bay only 2 days before Nielsa was found. As far as I can tell, Bernice and Gloria have never given off any indication that they know who this man is, and it's still unclear if his death has any connection to Nielsa's case, or if he might be the victim of a completely unrelated homicide. Whatever the case, after 38 years, Tommy Torso is still identified, Jorge Walter Nunez is still a fugitive, and Alicia Padilla continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. As I'm sure you're well aware, the use of genetic genealogy and DNA testing has allowed a lot of John and Jane Does to finally get their names back in recent years. Once they were identified, we've seen numerous examples of these decedents having a backstory which turned out to be completely different than anyone expected. If you look back at the original media coverage about the discovery of Teresa and Tommy Torso, you'll see speculation from law enforcement that their deaths were somehow connected to the drug trade, which was not an unreasonable assumption, considering that Miami was pretty much the Wild West during the 1980s when it came to drug-related violence. But in Teresa Torso's case, it turned out her murder had nothing to do with drugs, and she was the victim of one of the most horrific stories of domestic violence you'll ever hear about. Incidentally, it always saddens me when unidentified decedents wind up being saddled with undignified nicknames such as Teresa Torso or Orange Sock or Septic Tank Sam, so I always consider it a relief when we can start referring to these victims by their real names again. We can now refer to Teresa Torso as Nielsa Padilla, though sadly, Tommy Torso's true identity continues to elude us. So when I started digging into this case, I was really not prepared for how disturbing it was going to be, as Gloria Hampton and Bernice Davis both experienced the worst childhoods imaginable, which involved nonstop abuse and neglect, and they also had to witness the murder of their mother and possible murder of their little sister. Once they broke away from the clutches of Jorge Walter Nunez and were placed in foster care, Bernice and Gloria experienced a number of up and downs. But judging from their interviews on True Crime with Aphrodite Jones in 2015, it sounds like they were both in a good place and living normal lives with families and jobs, which is what they were deprived of during their childhood. Now, it's worth noting that both daughters have differing views on Nielsa, as she was not exactly the best mother to either of them. While Gloria has forgiven her, Bernice has said she does not, which may stem from the fact that Jorge was not actually her biological father, and I think she still resents Nielsa for bringing this abuser into her life. But it's worth reiterating that in spite of her mistakes, Nielsa did not deserve what happened to her. And while her initial reaction to Bernice's reveal that Jorge was sexually abusing her was pretty awful, she did ultimately confront him about it, and this is what led to her being killed. Overall, it's really hard to know how to classify this case, as it's essentially three unresolved mysteries rolled into one. We have a murder in which it's pretty cut and dried who did it, and there's an active arrest warrant for the perpetrator, but he is still a wanted fugitive, and we can't even be certain if he's still alive. We have a missing child who may have also been a murder victim, but she is yet to be found, and most bafflingly, we have a male victim that has never been identified and whose murder has never been solved, but we have no idea if he is connected to this whole story at all. So it sounds like the eyewitness accounts provided by Bernice and Gloria are strong enough evidence that Jorge could be arrested, charged, and put on trial for second-degree murder if he could be found. Of course, the biggest stumbling block is that he was deported back to Peru in 2004, and what's particularly frustrating is that even after he went to prison for sexual abuse, and Bernice and Gloria were removed from his care, no one seemed to believe them when they said they witnessed him beat their mother to death. Given their young ages, it sounds like they were just written off as having PTSD or false memories, but by the time the girls shared their stories, Nielsa had not been seen in 4 years, so what exactly did the authorities believe happened to her? Did they just assume that Nielsa skipped out and ran away and left her daughters alone with an abuser? I understand that information didn't travel as quickly during the late 1980s and early 1990s, and it wasn't as easy to match murder victims with unidentified decedents, but it is frustrating that the authorities had an unidentified Jane Doe right under their noses, and even after hearing the girls' stories, no one put two and two together. It's also troubling that there wasn't more urgency to find their missing sister, Alicia. Since Alicia was only 2.5 years old when she vanished, and her family pretty much lived off the grid the entire time she was alive, I get the impression that not many people even saw Alicia, and the authorities became skeptical that she even existed in the first place. It was not until Charles McCulley agreed to look at the case in 2010 and subpoenaed state records and found proof of Alicia's birth that he became convinced that Gloria's story was true. When McCulley agreed to open a new investigation and eventually identified Nielsa as Teresa Torso, Gloria said this was such a vindication for her because it proved that she and Bernice were not crazy and did not just imagine this traumatic murder they witnessed during their childhood. But of course, it was still a bittersweet feeling knowing that Jorge had been deported to Peru and was going to be difficult to track down. And it's particularly infuriating that the Miami PD blew Gloria off when she attempted to share her story in 2003, as Jorge was still in the US at that point and could have been arrested if they had taken her more seriously. I know there's been no activity on Jorge's Peruvian identification number in over a decade, but since he had lived under a number of different aliases in the past, that doesn't necessarily mean he's deceased. But if Jorge is still alive today, he would be around 80 years old, so the clock is ticking to find him. Of course, in addition to facing justice for what he did to Nielsa, one other reason to hope that Jorge can be tracked down is to question him about what happened to Alicia, as no proper missing persons investigation was ever performed for her. You have to feel particularly horrible for Bernice in this situation, because Alicia's disappearance came about because she didn't want to finish her cereal and decided to switch bowls with a younger sister in hopes that their father would hesitate to get violent on someone who was just a toddler. But unfortunately, it seems like Bernice underestimated just how monstrous Jorge really was, and the idea that this child may have been murdered over a bowl of cereal is truly sickening. The story provided by Bernice and Gloria is that Jorge returned home and hit Alicia in a fit of rage before taking her limp body out of the camper and telling the girls he was going to get help. But since they never saw her again, it's reasonable to assume that Alicia was already dead by that point or died a short time later, and Jorge disposed of her body before he returned. On the Aphrodite Jones episode, one of the detectives on this case was interviewed, and he did acknowledge the remote possibility that Alicia could still be alive somewhere today. Potential alternate scenarios are that Jorge could have sold Alicia or given her away to someone else or even abandoned her somewhere. Best case scenario is that Alicia was found by some good Samaritan who got her the necessary medical treatment, but since there was no record of her in the system anywhere, the authorities could not figure out her identity and placed her in foster care or adopted her out. Alicia was young enough that she would likely have no memories of her life with her birth family, so if she was raised under a different identity, she could still be out there somewhere today, completely unaware of who she is. However, I have to acknowledge that this scenario is probably nothing more than optimistic wishful thinking, and the most likely explanation is that Jorge was responsible for Alicia's death, and he got rid of her body at a location where it has never been found. Much like Nilsa, Jorge could have disposed of Alicia in a body of water, and it's a lot easier for a toddler to vanish without a trace than a grown adult. So yes, it seems very obvious that Nilsa and Alicia were both victims of a domestic violence homicide, and Jorge was the perpetrator. But the one aspect of this story which still continues to puzzle me is the unidentified John Doe, known only as Tommy Torso. When this story was featured on the Aphrodite Jones episode, there was no mention at all of Tommy Torso, so I have to wonder if investigators have perhaps ruled out the possibility that this victim had any link to Nilsa. Technically, his remains were discovered 2 days before Nilsa's were found, so it is possible that both victims were murdered by two completely different people. But even so, it's one hell of a coincidence that two unconnected victims would both be dismembered and have the remains dumped into Biscayne Bay and turn up within a third of a mile from each other. It would be one thing if there was a Dexter Morgan-esque serial killer operating in the area who was using Biscayne Bay as a dumping ground, but we know that that was definitely not the case with Nielsen's murder. One theory I've seen pushed forward is that Tommy Torso may have been a boyfriend or male friend that Nilsa had become involved with, and Jorge killed them both. But this doesn't mesh with the account provided by Bernisa and Gloria, who claim they witnessed Jorge beat Nilsa to death after he returned to their camper and she confronted him about his sexual abuse. At no point did the girls ever mention a male showing up there and being killed, though it does not sound like they were actually present when Jorge disposed of their mother's body. So theoretically, if Jorge was in the midst of dumping Nilsa's body in Biscayne Bay, and some random guy just happened to catch him in the act, perhaps Jorge killed him as well because he was a witness, and then proceeded to dismember him and toss his remains into the bay. But really, what are the odds of that happening? Another issue is that Tommy Torso had gunshot wounds in his body, and I'm not sure if Jorge even owned a gun. So perhaps the original theory about the murder being drug-related was actually correct in Tommy's case, and he was killed by someone else for completely different reasons, and by pure chance, he just happened to be tossed into the same body of water where another dismembered murder victim washed up. Like I said earlier, Miami was a pretty violent city during the 1980s, so I can't say this scenario is completely impossible. If Jorge is still alive and can be apprehended, I do hope the authorities question him about Tommy Torso's death, but if not, here's hoping that his DNA is on file, and one of these days he can be identified via genetic genealogy. Regardless of whether or not these two crimes are connected, they are both still unresolved, and the responsible parties have never faced justice. So if you happen to have any information about the current whereabouts of Jorge Walter Nunez, the disappearance of Alicia Padilla, or the identity of Tommy Torso, please contact the Miami-Dade Police Department at 305-471-2400. That's 305-471-2400. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Maria Sashery for narrating the opening of this week's episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, we have released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes on our Patreon, which are currently available in our archives. This past month, I released an episode about the 1995 death of David Chase, which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries and supposedly involved a murder victim returning from the grave in order to provide information about how they were killed. I've also released an exclusive bonus episode from my spinoff podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the unexplained 2002 death of Jamie Stickle. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Patricia A., Megan I., and Sean. Thank you all so much for your support. Anyway, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, which is being held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code, which can be used to get a 10% discount on tickets, so in order to do so, please visit crimecon.com and use the promo code COLD23. That's COLD23. And I wanted to mention that The Trail Went Cold will also be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. We've got a specialized promo code here as well, which you can use to get a 15% discount on tickets. So if you would like to purchase tickets, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com and use our promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's truecrimepodcastfestival.com and the promo code is TRAIL. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm sorry.